You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiotakis. The number of unhoused in LA County rose again in 2022 by about 4%. That's from the LA Homeless Services Authority, LHASA, which also shared this caveat.
While it is too soon to know what this year's count results will mean long term, the numbers are suggesting that there's a flattening of the curve, meaning the percent increase of people experiencing homelessness is shrinking over time.
Were eviction protections put in place at the height of the pandemic the reason for the stabilizing numbers? Nobody knows for sure right now, but tenants' advocates are concerned that there could be a flood of evictions as LA City and County plan to phase out those moratoriums, which have been protecting tenants struggling to pay rent amid shutdowns and job losses and health risks related to COVID-19. A couple of perspectives today, including from Elena Pop, an attorney and executive director of the Eviction Defense Network. Hey, Elena.
Hey, how are you?
I'm all right. The state of California already ended its eviction moratorium back in July. LA County looks like it's going to follow suit at the end of this year, and the city of LA soon after. So these protections only extended to people whose health and or income were affected by the pandemic, right? I mean, they're not blanket eviction moratoriums anyway.
Right. And they're not even moratoria at all. We keep using that word. An eviction moratorium would imply that eviction filings are prohibited. We've never had a law in place that prohibited eviction filings. What these laws do is they provide tenants protection against those evictions by providing them defenses. So, for instance, if the eviction is over failure to pay the rent and you are COVID impacted, in the city of Los Angeles, your rent is not due until August of 2023, and therefore you cannot be evicted for that rent. And in the city of Los Angeles, that rent debt turns into regular consumer debt that can be collected in a small claims case, but not in an eviction case. You have to, however, be able to start paying your rent in August. The county law is not dissimilar. It requires a little bit more notification to the landlord of the COVID impact. The county law has a little glitch, or a big glitch if you're affected by it. If you did not pay your rent in April, May, or June, you have no COVID protections if the only protection you have is the county law, because of a very complicated preemption argument between the state law and the county law that made the county law ineffectual for those 3 months. So we have tons of clients who got eviction filings during those 3 months.
Do you think, Elena, that the numbers that we're seeing, the homeless numbers that are just out from LHASA, have something to do with those protections?
Absolutely. Statistically, pre-pandemic, 49,500 evictions were filed in 2019. That's 3,381 per month. During the height of the protections between April 2020 and October 2020, that number went down to 338 average per month. That's a 90% reduction in eviction filings. Then, as the laws started to weaken, the eviction filings went up. Initially, with the first weakening, they went up to about 998 per month average. And then with the second and third weakenings, to about 1,500. And then when we lost the state protections in their entirety in June of 2022, those numbers went up to 3,397 for May, with comparable numbers for June and July. In addition, we saw at the height of the protections an increase in illegal lockouts. So I can tell you right now of at least 10 people who are blowing up my cell phone because it's picking up the lockout hotline right now, that were illegally locked up by their landlords and are currently homeless. Why would a landlord illegally lock something out? Well, because they can. And why can they? Because law enforcement refuses to enforce. We had a case this morning where an elderly person was illegally locked out by a landlord and the police refused to do anything about it.
So going forward, Elena, I mean, what are some, if these protections are ending, what do you do?
Well, we are still fighting to persuade the LA City Council and the County Board of Supervisors that the protections need to be extended. But if there are no protections, unfortunately, there are not enough lawyers. So we estimate that 500,000 people didn't pay their rent. The eviction rate is up to about 50,000 a year. The Right to Counsel Coalition probably has the capacity to help about 5,000. That's about 10% of the need. We need to be able to provide more representation to more people, because then either we find a defense and we then win the case, or we negotiate out what we call a soft landing, meaning no eviction on your record, some time to move and stabilize, and saved rent. So you can use that to move someplace else.
Well, thank you for coming on and talking to us. Elena Popp, an attorney and executive director of the Eviction Defense Network. Elena, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And now we're going to turn to Dan Uchelson, who's the executive director of the Apartment Association of Greater Los Angeles, or AGLA, A-A-G-L-A. Hey, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
You're a landlord. How have these eviction moratoriums affected your business?
Well, I'm not only a landlord. I run the Apartment Association of Greater LA, and I hear from hundreds of landlords literally every week. And it's really put owners in a terrible bind. For nearly 3 years, owners have had challenges collecting rent. And so it's been extremely difficult. And many owners today are faced with foreclosure or have had to sell their properties at a discount just to get out from underneath the burden of being in the rental housing business. And we're losing a lot of independent owners today.
What do you say about the talk, you know, that this the end of the eviction moratoria might result in this flood of evictions? I mean, do you think that's a real concern?
Well, at the end of the day, rental property owners are going to need to make a business decision. And with the amount of rental debt that's owed to many of them, it's simply not worth it to spend more money, which could cost up to $50,000 and take 6 months to try to evict somebody. And so in most cases, owners are going to be left with no other choice but to pay some of these renters for their bad behavior of not paying rent and working something out to just recover their units in hopes that they could rent to somebody who's, you know, going to be paying the rent and who could be more trustworthy.
I want to challenge you, though, on what you just said, bad behavior, though. But I mean, is it so much? I mean, yes, there are people who take advantage of the system. But is it bad behavior, Dan, or is it stuck? You know, I mean, this has been it's been a really crappy couple of years for a lot of people.
That's true. But how could you claim after 2 years that you're still impacted by COVID? You know, how many help wanted signs are out there and how many jobs are available today? You know, why not get out there and work and pay the rent? And I want to make one mention of something. And there's a difference between eviction lawsuits and eviction filings. And sure, there may be a number of eviction filings made, but you know, ultimately those cases won't be seen through the end. Owners won't want to chase after money that they'll ultimately never collect. It would be very difficult, even once a judgment is given, to ultimately collect that money, because in a lot of cases, renters just don't have the assets to go after. So in a lot of cases, these evictions may be filed just to put the owners in a position of being able to negotiate some type of settlement and recover their units. And that's what we see most of the time.
But again, renters are people, you know, they're human beings. And is there some sort of mechanism for landlords to work with folks to see if they can stay? I mean, look, if homelessness is up, but only a small amount, and it's because maybe there have been protections in place, if those protections go away, a lot of folks who can't afford apartments are going to be out on the streets. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, from the very beginning, owners were trying to work with their renters. And you know, the last thing owners want is to, you know, have turnover. And they like long-term renters. And, you know, I always say we're not in the eviction business, we're in the housing business, but there are those extreme outlier cases that I hear about every day of tenants that just have taken advantage. Now, if tenants have been impacted by COVID and they've been making efforts to pay and have been communicating with their landlord, that's a different story. You know, 99% of the time, owners are going to be willing to work something out with these types of renters. And, you know, you mentioned that renters are people. Absolutely. There are customers, but owners are people too. And most of the owners that I deal with at this association are people like me that own a couple of rental units that were invested in for retirement someday rather than putting my money and risking it on Wall Street. And I have a full-time job. And my job has been impacted by COVID, and many of these independent owners' full-time jobs have been impacted by COVID as well. Many have lost jobs, and many independent owners have come down with COVID too. Yet everything is so unbalanced in favor of the renters, and really very little was given to the owners.
It's certainly so much to think about and to chew on. I want to thank you for your time. Dan Uchelson, the Executive Director of the Apartment Association of Greater LA. Dan, thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come, from a penniless, homeless, and violent childhood to UCLA Law School and a successful career, the story of David Ambrose just ahead on the other side of this.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back now with more of Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
My family is a car accident on the side of the highway. Passerbys slow down long enough to gape, but do nothing or very little to provide life-saving aid. America watches its children suffer in poverty, shaking our heads in sadness and driving onward, thinking it's someone else's job to help those poor folks.
That's author David Ambrose. His new book titled A Place Called Home chronicles his early life growing up homeless, penniless, in and out of school, beaten violently and repeatedly by his mother, put in foster care where more bad things happen, and despite all that, against all odds, managed to get a scholarship to college and graduate from UCLA Law School. In the years since, he's risen to civic prominence as president of the LA City Planning Commission, and corporate prominence at Disney Television, and now as an executive at Amazon based here in Los Angeles, and all the while trying to make a difference in the lives of children growing up in poverty and foster care. David, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
Take us to the beginning. What was your life like in the years that most kids are in kindergarten or elementary school? I was particularly struck with just how much detail you remember from those early years with your mom and your siblings.
Yeah, my story starts 40 plus years ago, living in Grand Central and other public spaces in New York City. We were those homeless people that even today in Los Angeles, we kind of shake our heads at and wonder what to do. That was my family. And today, when I hear people say, clean it up, we were the it. And my life started born into homelessness, born into a mother suffering from mental health issues and a brother and a sister. And we struggled, and I think some of the detail you mentioned, when you and your life are just so often at risk, things are burnt into your memory, especially moments of profound pain or fear, very little joy. So my life began all those years ago homeless, where I spent the next 11 years living on the streets.
Your mother is a central figure of your life, the strong adult who leads the three of you kids from place to place, as you mentioned, Grand Central, but also Penn Station or wherever it may have been. But she could frequently be brutal, often yeah. being set off by something and then physically taking it out on you. And this is something that you wrote, quote, "Mom hits as often as she hugs, and I'd rather have neither than both." What do you mean
yeah.
by that?
I think mental health care is something in this country that's like a scarlet A. We still have so much shame associated with it. And my mom has been locked in a prison for 80 years of delusion and fear that I can't even imagine. And for my mom, her behavior towards me is something that I've learned to forgive. As I even start with the book, you know, my mom taught me to forgive from a very young age. She is not responsible for her actions. If she had cancer, we would not be upset with her. We'd be empathetic. But mental health care robs a lot of us, of our families. And even today in the state of California, we're passing the alternative courts for people suffering on the streets and their families. It's a recognition of what my family experienced and what I've experienced for decades, which is mental health care untreated, especially with families, lead to problems and struggles like my family's.
What did you think was going on with her when you were a kid versus what really was going on? I mean, you explain it quite well right here, but when you're 5 years old, none of that makes sense.
I think the opportunity and luxury of kind of deeper thought were often not something I experienced. What I thought in moment to moment is, what is going to happen next? What do I need to do to survive? And with so many of our poverty programs, especially for people with mental health issues or children, it's some sort of long vision that we expect folks to have when in the moment, in the day-to-day, they're struggling to survive. As a child, I wondered, where is my next meal coming from? Am I going to get hurt in the shelter? Where are we going to sleep tonight? Is my mom having a bad day mentally? And so what I struggled to understand with my mom was not long-term up until kind of my early teenage years. It was more, what is the next crisis that's going to happen and how do I get through it with my family intact? And that was something I think folks with mental health issues in their family probably can share a lot of empathy with.
You write about the many folks who watched and actually witnessed what you and your brother and sister suffered from and suffered with, but did nothing. And you went through so many homes with people who just didn't seem to care or had their own demons to battle as well. Since then, you have become an advocate, and I wonder if you see a way to make change.
Well, I always start from a place of optimism because my life is impossible. And yet here I am. I truly believe in the power of us as a people, as a city, as a state, as a country. We sent a person to the moon. We can figure out homelessness. I have a policy prescription, which is a love letter to an elected person and the public in the afterword of my book. It is common sense solutions to start chipping away at some of this. What we first have to do is not start from collectively driving by the car accident of homelessness. Instead of wondering every 4 years, I voted, why is this not fixed? What can I do? And it may not be to lift up that individual, but are you paying attention? Are you advocating for policies? Are you supporting people and asking questions? Do you care more than to complain? I'm often walking around Los Angeles and folks are railing against the city when in fact the county has much of the money and power and authority. But folks don't know who their county supervisor is. We have to hold these folks accountable. We have to be better consumers of politics. What do I think? I think, for instance, I'm working on a project here in Los Angeles. A third of the homeless, a third, are foster kids between the ages of 16 and 24. We can emancipate them not into homelessness, as we're doing. What if we built a dorm at LA City College or a community college? We own the land. You don't have to build parking. They get a vocational skill. With just a few of these dorms across the state, we've ended a third of the homeless. We've given these kids a life skill, a vocational skill, a two-year transfer. That is a common sense solution. It is a permanent systems fix. We can do this. The first step is believing that we can and then taking action. If you're not sure what to do, check out my website, read the book. There are some very common sense things we can do together.
That's ideal, right? The dorm at a college, vocation, that's all ideal. But that's not what happened to you in reality. What happened to you was social services came, took you and your siblings, took your siblings to a foster home, but they didn't know what to do with you, right? Because I guess because you're LGBTQ and they knew that somehow. And so they put you in a juvenile detention center?
That is true. There are just not enough foster homes. And when I was young, years ago, being queer was a diagnosis, and you were segregated, could be segregated and separated from quote unquote normal kids. And that is a huge problem. Queer kids are 20% approximately of the foster care caseload, 20%, double the percentage in the general population. There are not enough foster homes. So today it's much different, and that is not done. It's no longer policy, which is something I worked on as a young advocate, stopping that treatment of queer kids. But yet I remain optimistic that we can do better. And I am fighting for that every single day.
Despite your mother's illness and the violence toward you, she still managed to instill in all of you a belief in education. I mean, it can be hard for kids to process the many moods and the many meanings of parents with mental illness. And I wonder how you knew that was the thing to hold on to, education, reading.
Education really became a lifeline for me and my siblings. Siblings, especially in foster care, are such important supports in the absence of stability. Otherwise, your siblings are all that you have to anchor you to your past and give you hope in the future. My brother and sister were bookends, and they kept me upright. We did not go to school for much of my life and into high school, really. I went to a number of high schools. Education became this thing that I thought, gosh, if I don't want this, I'm going to need to do that. But not only that, it's also the place where we have outsourced not just education, but mental health care, feeding, social services. Schools have become everything. And they certainly were for my family. It was where teachers took an extra moment and slipped a snack bar into my bag, knowing I had no food at home, or the nurse treated me not just for lice, but with a bit of compassion. There were moments that I don't think I would have made it without that free school lunch. So I think education for me was more than just the imagination it gave me. It also gave me a place where I had some of my core and basic needs met. But I also knew that if I wanted to get out of this, which was all the situations I describe in my memoir, I needed an education. I needed an education, and I knew what I would do with it, which is why I went all the way through UCLA School of Law in order to get my law degree.
It's a harrowing and heartbreaking memoir, but it also has a happy ending, because here you are, right, telling your story to us. And I don't want to give too much of it away, because I want people to experience this themselves, right? I want them to read your story and go through it as you chronicled it. But at least for you, when you look back on all these years and the trauma of all of that, how are you doing now?
I have a beautiful life. I think of my life as one hell of an adventure. I think of it as Forrest Gump crashing into Hillbilly Elegy with a huge dose of Precious in there. I have had anything but a typical upbringing, and it made me, I think, hyper aware of the privilege and resources I have now. It made me a better tool to do good in the world. It made me a better, I believe, civic, engaged person. You mentioned the Planning Commission. I was a president of the Planning Commission in the second largest city in America, and I was able to help shape policies that help people like my family secure housing and make sure that they were centered in all of our thinking. What other place on earth? And that is because of the way that I was brought up. I am grateful for all the resources the public gave through foster care. I currently take care of my mom. I'm one of her caregivers, and I'm a proud foster father. And I'm really excited to be doing this book, hopefully to shine a light and carry on this torch to reignite a belief amongst all of us that we can do big things together. If I'm sitting here talking to you today, we can figure these problems out.
And if there's a little boy or a little girl who's listening to this program right now, to the sound of your voice, what do you tell them if they're experiencing what you were experiencing? What do you say to them?
I give in the dedication a acknowledgement to the hundreds of foster siblings I had. So many I can't remember their names, but their faces haunt me because too few made it. More foster kids will go to jail than go to college. More foster kids will become homeless than go to college. What do I say to those young people who I hope are listening? You can do it. I see you. We see you. It ain't going to be easy, but you'll look back and then you'll help other people forward, as I hope I can in my life.
David Ambrose, the author of the new memoir, A Place Called Home. David, thanks so much for coming on and sharing your story with us. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That's going to do it for us today. A powerful story there, one of many powerful stories that we have on this radio station for you time and time again. But a reminder right now that the KCRW Fall Pledge Drive is in its final couple of days. You can help support that service what you just heard, the show you just heard, the other programs you'll hear on this radio station day in and day out. And just to let you know, in recent years, we have tried out different links and formats for our drives. We're happy to say that this one is short and to the point. We're ending it tomorrow. KCRW.com/give. Get the podcast, by the way, wherever you get your podcasts or at the website as well. Jenna Cagle, Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Sonia Geis, Jay Siebold, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all helped shape this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for the ear. Have a great night.